So, first question. Could you ask everybody not to be that dead serious all the time? And wear a small smile.
Meditation, which is intended to bring us to the end of struggle and the end of suffering, can be producing a lot of struggle and a lot of suffering. And I think it's important for us to remind ourselves from time to time that one of the factors, one of the necessary factors, is joy. And certainly when I think of people who I consider to be, people who I know who I consider to really be awake and aware and free, they're all very joyful people, very happy people. And so I would ask you and I would encourage you to smile and to feel lightness and joy and to come to meditation not out of, oh, I should do it, or I'd better do it, or, but rather to come to meditation because of interest and because of curiosity and because of enjoyment, joy, delight, taking delight in the practice, taking delight in the inquiry, and this delight and this joy can take us a long way to really looking within and really coming to deep understanding. So please smile. What about awareness of vision? I'm not going to... maybe fortunately, I don't know who wrote this note, but there's a very nice little... And I can appreciate, and I don't intend this as a put down in any way. And I can appreciate the difficulty in translation in a Hebrew speaking person writing a question in English. And I know if I were to try and do something in Hebrew, I wouldn't be able to begin. But there's a little spelling mistake here, which I think actually has a lot of insight in it. And so what it says is, what about awareness of vision? Besides destructing the mind, visual has a purpose. And I'm assuming it's intended besides distracting the mind. But it's come out besides destructing the mind. And in a sense, at times, we can see how when we get caught up in visual things, it can destruct the mind in a sense. When we get caught up in the sense that we do get caught and we are grasping and holding and trying to keep the visual and searching for beautiful things, it is a kind of destruction. And it's also a kind of distraction. But does the visual have a purpose? And of course it has a purpose. It has the purpose that we see. And in seeing, we connect, and we know the connection. So in the meditations through these days, we began with the narrow focus on the breath, and we've gradually expanded, and we've included the body, we've included mind, we've included all the different mind states, emotions and things, and we've included tasting in the meals, touching, and we've included hearing, and of course we can also include seeing. And so seeing can be very much a part of the meditation, and indeed should be a part of the meditation. And when there's an understanding of seeing, it's neither destructing nor distracting. There's natural change all the time. What about us making deliberate changes? Should we let things be as they are and accept them without aversion, and then only change comes by itself? So a couple of evenings ago in the talk, I was speaking about the Four Noble Truths, and I got through the three and I almost forgot the fourth one, and then I just kind of remembered to say, oh yeah, there is a fourth one, and that's the path. And so maybe as a response to this question, I'll speak a little bit about the path, what the path is. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with it already and know what the path is. So the Buddha in this night that he spent sitting under this tree in Bodh Gaya, as I mentioned, had a number of insights. And one set of these insights was this, the Four Noble Truths. And the first truth was the fact of unsatisfactoriness, the fact of dukkha. The second truth was his recognition of the cause of dukkha, the cause of unsatisfactoriness lying in the grasping and aversion. And the third truth was the ending of suffering, the ending of dukkha. And the fourth truth, when after the Buddha was enlightened, awakened in Bodh Gaya, he walked off to Varanasi near Sarnath, I don't know how far, about 500 kilometers away, maybe a little less than that. And he found some friends who he had been practicing with, and he gave his first discourse to these five friends in Sarnath. And in this discourse, he explained to his friends that he wasn't convinced of his understanding. He wasn't absolutely certain of it until he was able to formulate a path. Until he was able to formulate a path which he could present, which other people could follow, and could also come to this awakening. So he was wanting to find a way so that this awakening wasn't just for him, but it could be presented to others, and it was possible for others to also come to this realization, to come to this awakening. And so he formulated this path before he began teaching, and when he gave this first discourse, in the first discourse, it's recorded towards the end of the discourse, one of the five understands, one of the five awakens. And the rest of the discourse is basically the Buddha expressing great relief that someone was able to understand it. And the Buddha expressing tremendous joy in this, that someone else was able to understand it. And I think that was what convinced him to carry on teaching. The fact that it wasn't just for him to understand, but it was accessible to others, and in fact is accessible to everyone. And so this path has eight parts to it. And so it's called the Noble Eightfold Path. And the first part of this path, and it's very interesting the order that the Buddha gives this path in. The first part of this path, the first of these eight, is wise understanding. And I think it's quite significant that he puts understanding first. Understanding comes first. And by wise understanding, he means the understanding of the nature of things, the understanding of how things are, the understanding of the truth of things. And I think that by placing it first, he's pointing out quite clearly, I think, that we do already have this understanding. The very fact of beginning on the path, the very fact of having interest in spiritual quest shows that there is understanding. So understanding comes first, and in response to this pile of questions, I'm going to come back to understanding a little bit later. The second of the eight is wise intention. And wise intention means wise intention means the absence of unwise intention. And this is a very interesting point. Very interesting point. The Buddha defines unwise intention. He says that unwise intention is the intention to ill will, to cruelty, to causing harm. And wise intention is the absence of that. And I think it's an important point, because what it points out is that the wisdom is not the acquiring of something. It's not the gaining of something. It's not the getting of something. But it's the removing of. In the removing of the unwise, the wise is shown. And again, the wisdom, the understanding, we have already. And the process is not one of getting understanding, but rather of uncovering it. And Peggy referred to the clouds and the sun. And that's exactly how it is. It's uncovering and revealing that which is already here. So wise intention is the absence of unwise intention. The third, and now I have to remember these. Third, fourth, and fifth are wise, excuse me, wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And so, in these three steps, the Buddha is very much bringing our so-called real daily life into the practice, into the meditation. An essential part of the path is bringing mindfulness, bringing awareness, bringing care to these aspects of our life, to our speech, to our actions, to our livelihood. So these areas of our lives are not to be overlooked. Our so-called real daily life is an essential part of the practice. Where were we? Oh, right. Wise action. That's where this came from. So this question has to do with action, making deliberate changes. It also has to do with the next three. So we've got five so far. So there's three more. The last three are wise effort. And so this question very much has to do with effort. So wise effort. And the next one is wise mindfulness. And the last one is wise concentration. So in the retreat situation, in the retreat conditions, we tend to put the majority of the emphasis on the last two. Mindfulness, concentration, And I think it's also interesting to see that the Buddha put concentration last. Understanding first, concentration last. And very often, we kind of think of it backwards. And we think, well, when I get thoughts of concentration, then from that concentration, or with that concentration, then understanding will come. So it's interesting the Buddha put it the other way around. Concentration is last. So wise action and wise effort. What about us making deliberate changes? So in the retreat setting, we can easily get the idea that meditation is just sitting here and being with whatever is happening and watching it and feeling it and letting it change and waiting for it to change. And so what? Sometimes it changes, sometimes it doesn't seem to change. Sometimes it definitely changes, but it seems to change for the worse. How's this coming? How's this bringing me to an end of dukkha? How is this bringing an end to dukkha? So the purpose of the meditation, as we've been saying from the beginning, has the two aspects, the calmness and the insight, the understanding of the nature of things. Insight and understanding brings wisdom. Wisdom is in the Eightfold Path, wise effort, wise action. And so the practice, in a sense, is, in many senses, the practice is to bring us wisdom. And sometimes the wisdom is to not just sit and watch and feel and wait for things to change, but to make wise effort, wise action, to take wise action. So what's wise effort and wise action? Wise action, wise effort is the actions and the efforts to bring us, to support us in coming to the ending of suffering. And so when we recognize that there's suffering, and we can see it here in the meditation, we're sitting and we recognize there's some pain. Pain comes in the knee, and we just sit with it and just wait for it to change. Pray that it will change. And we can get into this just staying with it. Okay, I'll just stay with it. I'll just allow it. I'll see the impermanence, and then it will go away. And there was another question here asking about pain specifically. Here it is. Physical pain is a message from the body for stop, change. Why not to answer? And the answer is yes, answer. Answer, it is a message. And the message is for wise action. And sometimes that wise action is to move. Adjust the posture. But as I've said in the instructions, mindfully. So much of our life is driven by habitual, automatic, mindless reactions to unpleasant and to pleasant. And we react, so often we react to the pleasant and the unpleasant in a way that we get in even worse messes. So wise action, wise effort is action and effort with mindfulness. And so in experiencing the pain, yes, we explore it. We allow ourselves to feel it. And we see that there's a message in here. And sometimes the message is mindfully adjust the posture. Sometimes, though, we get the wrong message. Or sometimes we take the first thought that comes into the mind as the message. So we feel the pain and the first thought is, oh, I'm going to destroy my knee. I'll never be able to stand up. Better move. Sometimes there's another message. There's another message. And sometimes the staying with and having a little patience, a little gentleness, a little interest can reveal another message. And just as an example, as one person mentioned in a small group, I think yesterday, there's the pain in the knee, and there's moving, and it's not just this one, but other people, I've heard many people say the same thing. There's a pain, move. A few minutes later, there it is again. Move again. There it is. Well, maybe I shouldn't be sitting cross-legged. Maybe I should sit on a bench. Move to a bench. Oh, there it is again. I'll put a cushion under here. Oh, there. Sit on a chair. There it is again. Doesn't matter. And finally you get to the point where you see it really doesn't matter how I sit. And there's a message coming through here. The message coming through that this pain isn't just saying move. It's not just because of the way I'm sitting or because of the shape of my knee. There's something else. And as this one person yesterday reported in the group, she noticed in staying with it, noticing that it didn't make any difference, and then in staying with it and going into it, noticing that the pain came whenever she was judging herself. And so the message isn't to move the knee. The message is, look at this self-judging. So wise effort and wise action is having this patience with ourselves, this kindness with ourselves, this gentleness, and this real listening, this deep listening to the messages, and not just reacting. Not reacting and listening to the very first message that comes. But giving time and patience. And when necessary, we take action. And similarly in our daily lives. To bring that same principle into our daily lives, to see in our daily lives outside of retreat, we have to take action. We have to make effort. But to bring wisdom to it, to bring clarity to it, to bring understanding to it, to bring patience, so that we can really be acting in life and not reacting. So that we can really be making effort which supports the ending of suffering, not efforts which are creating more suffering for ourselves and others. So sometimes we can see that just in allowing, change happens. And we can see this often with emotions. We can see if we can just stay steady with an emotion, strong emotion comes in. If we can just stay steady and not react, we can see that it passes. It may very well come back, but it passes. Some things we see do need some effort, do require some action. And so we take the action, we make the effort. But there is another question that comes up with that, and this is, all of these ones are related to it. And the question that comes out of that, well, we're making the effort, taking the action, but who is it? Who is it that's making the effort? Who is it that's taking the action? And all of these questions, I'm not my body, I'm not my thoughts, who am I? Who is the observer? What is it that decides where to put the attention? What is it in ourselves that is committed to the way? In my meditation, I realized I'm no more the Tai Chi teacher, not the bridge master, no more the businesswoman, etc. So who am I? If everything is changing and impermanent, who is watching? Excellent questions. I think the jackpot question. There used to be a program on television years ago called the $64,000 question. And at that time, $64,000 was a lot of money. And that phrase came into the language. And I'd say, this is the $64,000 question. Now there's a game show on television where the prize is $2 million. So I'd say, this is the $2 million question. Who am I? Who is it that's watching? Who is it that's feeling? Who is it that's knowing? I said at the beginning I was only going to answer easy questions. This one isn't easy. I'm going to continue reading a little bit from where Peggy left off. Where did she leave off? Somewhere on this page. Point 8. Okay, I'm going to jump to 15. Okay, 15. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. Dependent on the ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. Dependent on the nose and odors, nose consciousness arises. Dependent on the tongue and flavors, tongue consciousness arises. Dependent on the body and tangibles, touch consciousness arises. Dependent on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. The meeting of the three in each of these is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. In the instructions, when I was talking about the sounds and hearing, I mentioned how we're just sitting here, I'm just sitting here minding my own business, not doing anything, and suddenly I'm hearing a sound. A sound comes and I'm hearing. I haven't done anything. I haven't been looking for hearing, looking for sounds. I haven't been thinking about it. I haven't been trying to hear. It happens. How does that happen? Something makes a vibration. Something vibrates. Something moves in the air. And that vibration travels through the air, hits the eardrum. Okay, hits the eardrum. In that moment of the coming together of the eardrum and the vibration, hearing happens. This hearing is the ear consciousness, which the Buddha referred to. So the consciousness, the knowing of the sound, happens. I haven't done anything. It happens. It's a natural process. The coming together of these three, the coming together of that vibration, the eardrum, and the consciousness, the knowing of it, the Buddha refers to as contact. When there's contact, there's a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So the feeling arises dependent on the contact, the coming together. So again, it's not that I've done anything to make the feeling. It's not that the feeling is my feeling. It's a natural process. It arises out of the process of life. Based on that feeling, the mind, of course, the feeling is one quality of mind, one aspect of mind. The consciousness is an aspect of mind. And another aspect of mind, which the Buddha called perception. This other quality of mind perceives all of this. And by perception, by perceiving, what the Buddha meant was it takes it out. It separates it from everything else. It says sound. It makes it into a thing. And in that making it into a thing, then the mind has something to think about. And very often, the very first thought about it is, I'm hearing. I hear. And so the mind brings in this I, along with this perception, this impression of it being a separate thing. But in fact, it's a coming together. It's a coming together of things. Coming together of the vibration and the ear, the eardrum, and the consciousness. And they all come together. Hearing happens. With seeing, a light wave passes. I'm sitting here, eyes closed, doing my meditation. I open my eyes. A light wave comes through the air, strikes the eyeball. Seeing happens. I haven't done anything. There's been no effort. There's been no doing. It happens, a natural process. Seeing. The seeing consciousness arises. There's the contact. There's the feeling. Ah, I like what I see. It's pleasant. It's unpleasant. It's neutral. With the contact, the feeling, the perception, the separating it out, seeing you, seeing you, seeing the bell, whatever. The mind starts thinking about it, the proliferation, and comes in the eye. I see it. Similarly with smelling. Something comes through the air, hits the nose. Smelling happens. Tasting happens. The touch sensation happens. Thinking happens. The I comes in after. The I is brought into it by the mind. So we see these things happen as a natural process. And it happens so quickly, and this I comes in so quickly, and for some reason, the mind likes itself very much. The mind thinks that it's very clever and very brilliant and knows everything, or at least can know everything. And it knows, yes, there's an I. Of course there's an I. And of course it's me who's hearing, and of course it's me who's seeing, and it's me who's tasting. And the mind creates this image. It puts together all these seeings, hearings, tastings, touchings, thinkings, feelings. It puts together all these things and says, this is me. Here I am. And yes, here I am. Of course. Of course, here I am. But it's just a label. It's just a label that describes, gives us a way of talking about these hearings, tastings, seeings, touchings, smellings, and so on. So in this sense, there isn't really a me. So the question, who is knowing? Who is perceiving? Knowing is knowing. Seeing is seeing. Tasting is tasting. Touching is touching. Thinking is thinking. Some of you are familiar with the method of meditation that involves noting. And for those of you who aren't, this is a method of meditation that's used often by teachers in Burma. And what it involves is sitting and being aware of what's happening and actually labeling everything that we notice. So when we notice thinking, we label it. Thinking. Smelling. Touching. Planning. Feeling. So everything is labeled. And for a long time I puzzled about why is it thinking? Why isn't it just enough to say thinking? Why say thinking? Why hearing? Why not just hearing? Keep it simple. And I think what it's actually saying is hearing is hearing. It's not me hearing, it's hearing. It's not me thinking, it's thinking. It's not me tasting, it's tasting. But the mind puts it all together and says, it's me. It's me. Come back. Oh, this is a bit of a roundabout way of coming to all this. Coming back to the insight into the nature of things. Not just any insight. There's lots of different types of insight, but insight into the nature of things, which liberates us. Insight into the nature of things which liberates us, which frees us from the suffering. When we speak of insight into the nature of things, we speak of the nature of things. What does this mean? What is the nature of things? What is the nature of things? What are the characteristics of things? Well, how can we characterize? What can we say about things that characterizes them? And if it's going to be about things, then it has to be characters that apply to anything and everything. We've spoken a lot, maybe too much, about impermanence, judging by these questions. The message has gotten through. Impermanence. And when we start to look at things, we don't have to look too closely, I don't think. Don't think it takes a lot of deep investigation or inquiry to see that things are impermanent. Anything that we can identify or point to or talk about or conceive with our mind is impermanent. The body is impermanent, thoughts are impermanent, feelings are impermanent, emotions are impermanent, mind states are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. I think we all know that one. The clock is impermanent, the bell is impermanent. After years, it's going to rust away and disintegrate. The clock battery is going to run out and it's going to die. Intangible things, the wind is impermanent, it changes, the trees, anything, everything is impermanent. We see this, we can recognize this. Countries are impermanent, governments are impermanent, thank God. In terms of liberation, what's the importance of this? What's the significance of this? Why is it important that we understand this? Why is it important for us to really deeply take this in, that things are impermanent? Sounds are impermanent. If we recognize and understand that suffering is caused by grasping and by aversion, and the understanding of impermanence, the recognition of impermanence, we can see that there is in fact nothing that we can hold on to. We can't hold on. And some of us have recognized this and have commented on it in the meetings. I see that I can't hold on to it. I can't hold on to my identity of who I am. I can't hold on to objects. I can't hold on to ideas. I can't hold on to anything because it's changing. The more deeply we see that, the more deeply within our being we know that and feel that and experience that, the more deeply we see we can't hold. And in that seeing, there's a giving up of the attempt to hold. A giving up of the attempt to hold. And in that giving up of the attempt to hold, there's a releasing. And it's not a releasing that's an effort, that's a doing. It happens as a natural process. It's a natural process. I see so clearly there's nothing here to hold on to. It's pointless. So impermanence and the knowing, the understanding of impermanence allows for this releasing. In this releasing is at least a lessening of the unsatisfactoriness. Another characteristic of things is unsatisfactoriness. Things are unsatisfactory. There's a quality of unsatisfactoriness. What does that mean? Why? Why are things unsatisfactory? Because they're changing. We can't hold on to them. We can't depend on them. We can't rely on them. We can't find any lasting security in them. We can't find any lasting happiness or peace in them. Because they're changing and we can't keep them. And so things have this quality of unsatisfactoriness. Things can give us a temporary satisfaction, a temporary enjoyment, a temporary pleasure, a temporary happiness, but they'll change. And we can see this when we look in our lives. We can see how often something that has given us much joy and much happiness and much pleasure, and we've really treasured and cherished, and something changes, and then there's suffering in it. There's unsatisfactoriness in it. We see it in relationships. We see it in the sunshine, even. The sunshine just feels so wonderful. Oh, it's just beautiful to lie in the sun and feel the warmth. But if you lie there too long, suffering changes. So we know that this quality of unsatisfactoriness arising out of change. And the knowing of this unsatisfactoriness, when we know this, when we recognize that something is unsatisfactory, again, there's a releasing. To know this quality of unsatisfactoriness so deeply that the releasing happens in the same way that when I pick up, if I pick up something that's really hot, I release it. And I don't have to say, how do I release this? What do I do to release this? How do I let go? It happens. It happens from the knowing of the unsatisfactoriness. And hopefully we can know the unsatisfactoriness of something before it gets to that point of burning us. To be aware of that quality of things, that nature of things, before it burns us. So impermanence, unsatisfactoriness. Third quality, and the Buddha very wisely through his investigation and his mindfulness, he identified just three factors, three qualities, three characteristics that he believed could be applied to all things. And one was impermanence, one was unsatisfactoriness, and the third one is the word in Pali is anatta, and it literally translates as without self. Without self. The absence of self. And so in a roundabout way, this comes back to seeing happens, hearing happens, thinking happens, feeling happens, smelling happens, thinking thinks, smelling smells, knowing knows. It's not me. It's without self. It's without me. It's just a process of life happening. And so this is one way in which not self, in which anatta shows. Another way that anatta shows, and another kind of meaning of, or way of understanding anatta, is in this process of hearing, of tasting, of touching, of smelling, and so on. We see that the hearing arises from the coming together of the ear and the vibration. It's a coming together, connection. Hearing happens with that connection. Tasting happens with a connection. Smelling happens with a connection. Thinking happens with a connection. The mind comes in and says, me, but what it's calling me isn't separate from. What I call me is not separate from anything else. Because this image, this creation of me arises out of these connections. It arises dependent on the things that it connects with. So the I, the me, doesn't exist separately. And so it's said to be without a self. There's not a self in the sense that there's no separate. There's no separate self. There's no separate me. And to see this and to know this and to understand this very clearly, there's another releasing. There's a releasing of me. And it doesn't mean that this formation, this thing here, disappears and dissolves away and vanishes and gets blasted off into nothingness. It simply means there's a knowing that this me is not separate from. This me doesn't exist independently of anything else. And so there's a releasing of this me. In the releasing of me, there's a releasing of this self-centered view of the world that we have. This perception that I'm here and you're there. This perception that there's me and you. It's just a perception. It's just a perception. And letting go, releasing that perception. The Buddha says here, there is a greed that fixes on the individual body-mind. When that greed has completely gone, then there will be no more inner poison drives, without which you are immune from death. This is the greed that fixes on this me. And when that's seen, when that's known, when that's understood, this greed drops away. And we see the interdependence, we see the connection. And in that seeing, in that knowing, in that immediate experiencing, I see you. I see another person, I feel another person, and I know that connection. To know that there's no separation, there's no separation whatsoever. And to know it so clearly that to see another person, to speak to another person, to hear another person is to see myself, to speak to myself, to hear myself. And to understand that and to know that, from that springs loving kindness and compassion and caring. Because we're not separate. To know my suffering is to know the suffering of everyone. To know another person's suffering is to know my own suffering. And we can see this, we can feel this. We see a person, we're walking down the street and we see a person who's clearly suffering. And we feel it. We feel it. And we respond to it. And we can ask the question, is this suffering? Is it that person's suffering? Is it my suffering? No. It's not separate. And the natural response to this is compassion. This is the significance of understanding not self. The Buddha says, what did he say?
A letting go of the world is peacefulness. There's nothing that you need hold on to, and there's nothing that you need push away. Dry up the remains of your past and have nothing for your future. If you do not cling to the present, then you can go from place to place in peace. He says, there is in taking things a thirst, a clinging, a grasping. You must lose it. You must lose it all together, above, below, around, and within. It makes no difference what it is you are grasping at. When a person grasps, Mara, death, stands beside him. Therefore, people realizing this should not grasp at anything being mindful. He should see the beings that are creatures of attachment as tied to the power of death. Hmm. person.
We see the suffering and the grasping. Grasping to things, grasping to ideas, grasping to concepts, grasping to anything. As the Buddha said, above, below, around, and within. Grasping to anything. When we see the suffering, we see the impermanence, we see the not-self, the anatta, we begin to let go, to release. And I think we've all had the experience of feeling the calmness and the peacefulness that comes when we let go of something that's causing us suffering. When we let go of something in the midst of suffering, in that releasing, there's a peacefulness. We let go, and we let go, and we let go, and in stillness and in silence, we can see more and more subtle layers of grasping, of aversion. And we see it, and we let go, and we let go, and we let go. The Buddha says, there is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of no-thingness, a place of non-possession and of non-attachment. It is the total end of death and decay. And this is why I call it Nirvana, the extinguished, the cool. There are people who, in mindfulness, have realized this and are completely cooled here and now. They do not become slaves working for death, for Mara. In this releasing, in this letting go, this effortless releasing, this releasing is a natural process. And seeing more and more subtly the grasping, the unsatisfactoriness, and the releasing. We pay attention to things. We bring mindfulness to things, to the body, to the mind, to sounds, in order to come to this understanding of the nature of things. We pay attention, we bring mindfulness to come to this understanding, to come to this insight, which allows for the releasing. And in the releasing, in the total releasing, in the total releasing, And this is a process. Peggy quoted the line from the Buddha, lose the fascination with things that come and go. And in seeing the unsatisfactoriness and seeing the impermanence, we lose this fascination. We lose the interest. These things just don't interest us anymore because we see what they do to us. We see what we do with them, how the grasping brings up the unsatisfactoriness. And so we lose this fascination. And things lose their importance. Letting go, letting go, letting go. And in a moment of this letting go is the possibility of knowing something which is not of things. In the removal of the things. And this doesn't mean the getting rid of them. Things don't just suddenly vanish. It's just not being grasped. And then something else can show, something else can show, something which is not of things, something which is not, which does not come and go, something which is not, it's not impermanent, and it's not permanent either. Something much deeper, much more profound, much vaster, but which can be known. And this is what the Buddha referred to as the deathless. And so the meditation is for this understanding, that this insight, this understanding that brings us wisdom and brings compassion and brings us to know the deathless. Or if we could sit quietly for a few minutes together.